Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. October is here, and with it comes National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So we're launching a weekly series to help promote greater awareness on the subject, as well as reminding victims about the wealth of resources and support professionals out there ready to help you get your life back and stay safe. Today, we're going to learn about the Domestic Violence Crisis Center and how they're focusing on numerous aspects of preventing domestic violence, including financial abuse. Is someone controlling you with their financial capabilities? If so, stay tuned. Then we're going to chat with two very dedicated representatives who are instrumental in forming the Connecticut American Legion Foundation. We're going to discuss the important civic-minded programs the foundation is already supporting, as well as explaining how you or your employer or community group can get behind building and expanding many other American Legion-sponsored initiatives. Then we're going to close on a musical note with the director of the Greater Bridgeport Symphony, which is in the process of choosing a new conductor while continuing to bring the beauty of symphonic music to folks throughout the region while exposing school-age audiences to the symphony and myriad possibilities future careers in musical and cultural arts organizations can bring. We'll be right back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. As we know, the Atlantic hurricane season is in full swing, and the next major storm might only be days away. So the American Red Cross is urging everyone who lives in hurricane-prone areas to make preparations now and is issuing a call for more people to volunteer to respond to these emergencies. The need to help during disasters has never been greater, so you can join the Red Cross to provide relief and hope when it matters most. Visit redcross.org/volunteer to sign up now, and for preparedness tips to keep you safe this hurricane season, download the free Red Cross emergency app at redcross.org/apps. So here we are, October, the very first weekend of October and the very first segment in October. We'll kick off a weekly series of talks that we're going to be having and conversations with individuals who are focusing on October because it is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And regular listeners and longtime listeners know how much Connoisseur Media and the award-winning For the People is dedicated to educating individuals about domestic violence and its many facets, as well as connecting victims with the wealth of resources available here in Connecticut for them to be able to escape, to get their lives back, and to do it safely. So that said, we're so pleased to kick off Domestic Violence Awareness Month with Suzanne Adams. She's Executive Director of the Domestic Violence Crisis Center. Since 1980, they've been providing counseling and advocacy services for victims of domestic violence and their children. They're the only state-certified agency recognized by the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence, serving the communities of Norwalk, Stamford, New Canaan, Darien, Westport, Weston, and Wilton. So, Suzanne, here we are, October, and I imagine that means you're really, really going to be even busier than you normally are. And sad to say, we haven't put you or any of the coalition partners out of business yet. And I imagine even though situations related to the pandemic have eased up a little bit, issues around domestic violence have not.
Absolutely. First of all, John, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here. And yes, this is a wonderful time. Domestic Violence Awareness Month happens once a year. And what we like to say at DVCC is that happens once a year, but we're still here the 11 months out of the rest of the year to provide support and services for everyone. And it's also a great time to remind ourselves, our neighbors, that domestic violence is about power and control. It's not just an unhealthy relationship. It's a process. Someone's trying to control someone through financial abuse, technology abuse, sexual abuse, financial abuse, many different tactics, not just physical. People can be verbally abused, and these things happen over time. It's not just a bad night or a bad weekend. Very often, domestic violence, the process of someone's life is impacted in many different ways, and that's why it's really important that individuals know that help is available right in their own backyard.
And also important to know that you guys are there 24 hours a day, 365 Absolutely. Days a year. You've got a hotline, two safe houses, counseling for adults and children, legal advocacy, housing and financial advocacy, as well as educating thousands of young people every year to be the next first front line of defense, if not for themselves, for somebody that they love. Tell us a little bit briefly about the outreach that you folks are doing.
Absolutely. With, Domestic Violence Awareness Month is obviously a special month. You know, we have magnets on police cruisers and purple ribbons. And on October 20th, it's Wear Purple Day. So people can send in selfies and pictures or hashtag purple, purple awareness. There are a lot of wonderful things taking place during the month of October. A lot of great coffee houses local to all of our areas doing great coffee sleeves to raise awareness that love does not equal abuse and to let people know that help is available. But outside of this very, busy and exciting month, we also do have education. We educate people from a human resources department at a local company to our schools, to our cities and our towns. We reach out to individuals if they have a club, and even just doing education and training and letting people know what the dynamics of domestic violence is, what people can do to help. And I think the most important outreach that anyone can do, it's not necessarily the staff at DVCC, even though they're incredibly tireless and hardworking and wonderful people. It's the people listening to your wonderful broadcast today, understanding that the awareness starts with us. It starts with each individual knowing that help is available in your own community. And if someone just has a question, they're not sure if they're being abused. They're not sure if their friend is being abused. Sometimes people feel uncomfortable when an argument or disagreement feels like it goes past the point of peace, but they don't think it's abuse. We don't hear it all the time. She didn't get hit or pushed or slapped, but someone's still really uncomfortable with what they're hearing from a friend or a neighbor or a coworker, or they're uncomfortable with what they're witnessing. Very often we point out that when someone is verbally or emotionally or putting someone down or using their physical presence to intimidate another person outside in the world, whether it's at soccer practice or at an event or over the summer, I witnessed this at our pool that we were at. What they're doing in public, they're also doing this at home, and what they're doing at home is typically much worse. So if anyone is ever curious or wondering, you can reach out to our website, dvccct.org, or you can call any of the numbers just to know help is available. And we're here to help you process and to help people lead safer lives.
And speaking of the issue not going away, I have to extend my gratitude and amazement your way, because you and your team just last year provided almost 4,000 individuals with direct support, which was free, confidential, multilingual, and multicultural. And I want to focus just for a moment or two on the multicultural piece, because while certain cultures are very advanced in terms of self-advocacy, others are not. And there is still a huge stigma that rests not only with those from the cultures that are strongly self-advocating, but among other cultures, many of which exist in the communities where you serve.
Exactly. That is probably one of the great things I'm extremely proud of this organization, that someone coming in for help will recognize themselves within our community, within our small community. We just had a staff meeting yesterday, and we have Haitian, Argentinian, Chilean, Peruvian, Ecuadorian. We have so many different staff members from different cultures and different life experiences, all highly trained to support each individual wherever they are at. It is very important for me, to our board, and to our community, for people who are coming in for help and services to be receiving help from people who they feel comfortable with. And if there is a language barrier or a culture barrier or any other type of barrier to service, someone is not going to be safe at home. So it is very important for us to not create more, but to eliminate those barriers for someone to be able to get the help and safety and support that they need.
Great. Well, part of the way that DVCC is able to continue to provide and expand these robust multilingual, multicultural services is through the underwriting that comes from events like the one you have coming up on October 21st. It's your Harvest Fest at the Shore Haven Golf Club in Norwalk. Cocktails on the terrace, dinner, dancing, live music. We're going to talk a little bit more about that before we wrap up this morning, Suzanne. But what I really want to do now is spend a few minutes talking about a couple of the unique types of domestic violence that you guys have been so well equipped for and are utilizing so well. You mentioned the list of different types of abuse, and gaslighting is among them. And for people that may have heard the term but didn't really like look it up or really fully understand it, when you use gaslighting in conjunction with a domestic violence situation, what does that mean?
That really is a tactic to confuse and unsettle someone. It's disturbing their peace. Gaslighting is something as simple as I put my glasses down in the living room, I go back to get them, and they're not there. Someone physically moved something, and I'm looking all over the house for something. Gaslighting is giving people the perception, to use the vernacular, it's a simple term, as am I going crazy? It's creating unreal and unnecessary moments and experience for a person to feel really unsettled, incredibly insecure, and or making them feel that things are happening. As simple as an individual going into the home, I turned off all the lights. You go home, 20 minutes later, all the lights are back on. The partner turned all the lights back on to trick, to make someone insecure, to make them realize that they're not in control of their own life. See, that's why I'm here. If I weren't here, you would leave the lights on all the time. When really it was the partner who turned the lights back on to trick the person to believe that something happened. Deleting emails. Mm-hmm. I sent the email. No, you didn't. It's not in your outbox because someone had access to your technology. It's, you know, that bait and switch to truly make someone feel physically, emotionally, psychologically, and intellectually unstable to be able to. And over time, the more and more it happens, people can become paralyzed because you can't make any right move because you feel that everything you're doing is wrong. Yeah. When actually you have another person behind the scenes pulling and creating all of these moves to create an environment where you are not only insecure, but you need to lean on that person for stability because you're doing something, quote unquote, wrong.
Yeah.
It's very pervasive. You don't even realize it's happening until you're deep into it. And that's why it's important for people to understand that that is a tactic of coercive control that people can use. That's not physical. It's not emotional. It's really in there just to get people off their kilter, if you will.
The other insidious way that certain abusers employ to try to keep control over their victim is with financial abuse, which is another area where you and your team really shines in terms of educating folks and being able to make them aware of that fine line that would define them as a financial abuse domestic violence victim, in which case they could seek out the assistance and support of your agencies or others in the coalition to get the help they need.
Right. Financial abuse is wild in the sense that people don't really realize how pervasive it is. Financial abuse occurs in 99% of all domestic violence cases. And unfortunately, it is an incredibly effective method for an abuser to maintain power control over a victim, a partner, a wife, a friend. If we remember that domestic violence is rooted in power control, it's understandable that controlling someone's finances and their access to money is one of the most effective ways to keep control over them. And financial abuse can look like something like sabotaging someone's credit score, keeping PIN numbers to bank accounts from them, changing PIN numbers and bank accounts so they don't have access to them. We have seen several cases lately of abusers withholding food from the victims and from the children. And unfortunately, it's really hard to get out from under this kind of abuse. If a victim stays home to care for their children, they may lack the job training over time or the experience to earn enough income to live independently of an abuser. And if victims do leave, they may end up facing a homelessness simply because they don't have the access to money that their spouse or partner may have. And it's really important to know that because domestic violence is the leading cause of homelessness for women and children in the United States.
So I was going to say, enter the wonderful and talented Marilyn Hart and her team on your housing and financial advocacy program. That's where this kind of work comes in.
Absolutely. We actually have been recognized as a model program within the state of Connecticut and beyond for helping survivors recover from financial abuse. And last year, we helped 265 survivors and their children avoid homelessness and recover from their financial abuse through Marilyn and her team's advocacy.
So for folks who have a fear that calling their abuser on financial abuse and trying to disconnect from the situation where they feel they're literally being held hostage in their own dwelling or place of residence, this team has both the education and the connections to be able to bail somebody out of that.
Absolutely. And also the expertise, because it's always important. If you think about when someone's having a baby, right? Did you pack the bag? What's in the go bag when someone needs to go to the hospital? That's also important before someone jumps out of the domestic violence plane to understand what you need when you land. And the training and the education and the support of the human beings who are doing this work with their whole heart and their incredible talents and skills will ask you questions to help you make decisions based out of information instead of making decisions about your financial, personal, professional life out of decisions out of fear. And it's really important that people have the tools and the information to be able to bring their lives back to wholeness and to lead a safer life.
So if people want to make a difference this National Domestic Violence Awareness Month or any time year round, they can go to dvccct.org for the Domestic Violence Crisis Center of Connecticut, dvccct.org. They can inquire about volunteer opportunities, single day projects for folks that may need help. They can donate grocery gift cards or gas cards, which are so critical for the folks that you help. But then they can come out and get to know you and your team and even maybe some of the folks that you have helped at the Harvest Fest. So let's wrap it up inviting folks out to try to support that event.
Right. It's going to be such a fun event. This is our fourth year, second year in person, actually third year in person. We had 2 years due to the pandemic. We did it virtually, but what a difference it makes being in person, being able to support one another, understanding a number of our staff members will be there so that people can learn about what we do. But most importantly, we're having cocktails on the terrace. It's dinners, it's dancing, it's connecting. The one thing that we realize more importantly than anything else, a connection to another person gives gives everyone, each and every one of us, the ability to thrive and support and to be able to just live authentically and fully. And so with a little bit of dancing and some great live music from a fake ID, it's a really, really fun event. And we spend a little bit of time talking about domestic violence and educating people why they're having a lot of fun for a really important cause. And we're very excited. Tickets are going soon and quickly. Good. And we really hope people are able to make it and enjoy and celebrate all the wonderful work and celebrate life. Great. At our Harvest Festival.
Let's close it out with the hotline or the way that folks can get immediate help.
Absolutely. People can call our 24-hour hotline at 1-888-774-2900. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We're here to help you whether you're in a crisis, whether you just have a question, or you just need support and a gentle, calm voice on the other end of the phone. We are here for you.
DVCCCT.org is the website. The Domestic Violence Crisis Center's role is helping those experiencing any level of domestic violence and assisting them in building a safer environment for the well-being of themselves and their families. I want to thank Suzanne Adam, their executive director, for helping us kick off October as Domestic Violence Awareness Month here on the award-winning For the People. Suzanne, great work, and we will talk to you again soon. So I'm so pleased at this point to be talking with a couple of gentlemen representing a very important organization here in Connecticut. Ron Kader is with us, as well as Everett Shepard. They're representing the American Legion and the American Legion Foundation. And I tell you, you know, New Haven's kind of ground zero for the American Legion with its big headquarters here. And also want to send a quick shout out and thanks to Sue Daigle, who I've known for these 30 plus years and has helped facilitate our call with these fine gentlemen this morning. So Ron and Everett, thank you for joining me. We want to talk about the recent launch of this Connecticut American Legion Foundation and kicking it off so effectively with this Developing Tomorrow's Leaders sort of initiative.
Right. The foundation itself was established by the American Legion Department of Connecticut, meaning the state of Connecticut, as a wholly owned 501(c) subsidiary and incorporated in the state of Connecticut. And it took us a while for the directors of the foundation to get organized and fine-tune the bylaws, but then we realized we needed to build the foundation if it's going to be effective. And the goals of the foundation when it was organized was to raise capital in support of our Legion Americanism programs, our high school boys state program, our other children youth programs, our baseball program, our oratorical program, and veterans affairs and rehabilitation programs. So that's the long-term goal. If we'd have done this 20 or 30 years ago, maybe we would have had a foundation built up sufficiently to be providing support today, but we want to provide support in the future for the perpetuity of all of those programs.
Right. So one of the programs you mentioned was Boys State. What is that all about?
Happy to tell you about that. I've been working the Boys State program for 45 years. It's a high school program for boys at the end of their junior year before they go back for their senior year. And it's a week-long program held at a university that teaches the boys about politics and government, local and state government, through role-playing. They actually, it's a learn-by-doing process. They actually form political parties and then run for office and then actually execute those offices. It's a pretty intense program for a week, and the boys go back and have that experience to take back to their schools for their senior year.
So Everett, with the many years you've been in this program, you had to have seen some, early or maybe even very recent Boys State participants graduate not only out of high school, but into some form of appointed or elected municipal or state political service.
Absolutely. Some famous graduates of our Connecticut Boys State program, current Senator Chris Murphy went through the program, and so that's a highlight. We have a former governor that went through the program, and for those who you may have seen, the famous picture of Bill Clinton, President Clinton, as a youth attended the Legion National Boys Nation program from the Arkansas Boys State program. So there's a lot of people that have gone to the various Boys State programs in their respective states and taken that as a springboard to get into politics and public service.
And not just high-ranking positions. I mean, the business of municipal service and the kind of support that is brought by the many smaller boards and commissions across Connecticut's 169 communities have probably benefited greatly from many people who came through this program.
Yeah, this is Ron, John, and that's a very true statement that you just made. We have kids that, and they're all adults now, because even those that graduated last year are adults in my book.
Yeah, but not everybody wants to be the mayor or the first selectman. So, maybe some people have an interest in, a public building commission or, tax collection or the legislative process of making local things happen.
That's true. And, in fact, one of the people that were quoted in our little rat card that we sent out is a young man who serves on a board of selectmen here in Putnam, and he talks about how the Boys State really affected his life and made him see that there were other people of his caliber around and that those were the kind of people that he would be dealing with in the future. And also, from a personal point of view, I had two of my sons who participated in Boys State, and one of them today is a graduate of Notre Dame University, and he owns one business, is in the process of looking for another business to own. And so he's learned a lot of not only about politics, but about the business world, finance and education, etc. So it's all come into play for him.
Excellent. Ron Cordero and Everett Shepherd are with us in this midpoint segment talking about the relatively newly formed Connecticut American Legion Foundation. We're going to come back and talk more about that and how you listeners may be able to help create the foundation upon which this foundation will continue to not only build the civic-mindedness of young people here in the state of Connecticut and beyond, but also expand its programming to reach and benefit many more young people. We'll be back in just a few moments. Stay with us. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. So have you heard about Ridgebury Farm and Stables? It's an equine-centered holistic wellness and nature therapy farm on 56th Pastoral Acres in Ridgefield. With private trails, that's the home of Ridgebury Riders, a nonprofit specializing in occupational physical and speech language therapy, as well as equine-assisted therapy. Well, Ridgebury Farm and Stables is hosting their first Ridgebury Riders Farm Feet on Friday, October 21st from 6 to 9. It's going to have food, cocktails, live music, and inspiring success stories. Funds from the event are going to go directly to the Ridgebury Riders program to assist participating riders, as well as ongoing care for its therapy horses and specialty tack needed for therapeutic riding. If you'd like to purchase tickets or consider being a sponsor, just visit RidgeberryFarm.com. We are back with Ron Cordair and Everett Shepherd. They represent American Legion here in Connecticut and the Connecticut American Legion Foundation, relatively newly formed, but with great foresight on what they would like to accomplish. One of the other things, Everett, that you mentioned was State Police Youth Week, which is another component and the type of a program that you would like to continue and grow here. Briefly, what is that all about?
That is a really cool program. Unfortunately, we only send about 25 to 30 kids a year to that program because of capacity limitations, but it's run by the State Police at the State Police Training Academy in Meriden. We started it in 2000 when I was the state commander of the American Legion, and it's co-ed. Boys and girls can go at the end of their junior year before their senior year. And they have a week-long program. It's a microcosm of state police recruit training. So if they're interested in law enforcement or getting becoming an attorney or in any aspect of that public service sector, it's a great, great experience for them. And we have, at this point, graduates that went on to become local and state policemen in both Connecticut and outside of Connecticut and other states.
Great. Very nice. So the bottom line is, in the last few minutes that we have with you guys, you're looking to get some allies and some supporters together. You really want to create this benchmark endowment through which the money can flow and grow to expand more programs like this State Police Youth Week and Boys State, which are already running very successfully and actually, you know, are at or over capacity. So what can people do, and what are the other kind of programs that you're looking to expand or acquire through the further work of the Connecticut American Legion Foundation?
Well, John, as the, I guess you might call me the chief fundraiser of this program, because that's been my whole career, as professionally raising money for nonprofit organizations. But trying to demonstrate the worthiness and the value of this foundation in what it will do to the future and building future leaders. So it's not only Boys State and State Police Youth Week, but it's also baseball. It's the oratorical contest. It's Americanism programs. It's taking care of veterans and sometimes veterans' families when the veterans are no longer around. So it's going to be a wide-ranging thing. So we would like anybody out there. First of all, we've contacted 16,000 Legionnaires in the state of Connecticut to ask for their support. But any veterans or any individuals or corporations, anyone who's interested, we would be glad to speak with them about this program. And I will give you an address if I can, so you can use it in the future. But they could contact the, in fact, it's our good friend Sue Daigle at the Connecticut American Legion headquarters on 269 Main Street in Cromwell, Connecticut. The zip is 06416. And the number that they can call, if they would like to, is 860-436-9986. And the email address is ctlegion.org. So there's a lot of ways they can get in touch with us. We would be glad to talk to anybody. And it's a futuristic thing. It's an endowment. It's something that will go on in perpetuity, as Everett said earlier.
I'd like to say, too, that for those that are technically proficient, it's easy to go to the Connecticut Legion website, ctlegion.org, and there's a button to click there for an online donation directly to the foundation.
And of course, and you guys have established the foundation as a 501c3. It is tax deductible. And go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if I could give a shout out to your friend and my friend, Sue Daigle, and The other lady that works in the office with her, Jess Abel, they have been fantastic. But we've also had the support of our department adjutant, which is Harry Butch Hansen. And we've had the support from Waterbury area of Jim Russo, the commander of Post Sure. 1 in Connecticut, who has been our technical man. And as a quick update, in the first 2 weeks of this program, we've raised approximately $10,000 towards our goal of $33,000. And we're averaging a gift of about $60 per gift that's been coming in. It ranges from a high of $1,000 to a low of $1 from some old World War II veterans who that's all they can afford to send in. But we have gotten two or three gifts like that in the range of $1 to $5. So it's been a fantastic response, and we've been very encouraged by it. And we encourage anyone that would like to support us. We'd appreciate that. And that information I gave you before is where they can get in touch with us.
Well, you know, if you get 100,000 Connecticut residents each given a dollar, you guys are going to be in great shape to sustain and expand the existing programs, as well as acquiring and expanding new programs. Ron Cordier and Everett Shepard, representing the newly formed Connecticut American Legion Foundation. CTLegion.org is the website. You can go make your tax deductible contribution to build the foundation of this organization. You can call 860-436-9986. These donations will go far towards creating the future leadership of our communities here throughout Connecticut and beyond. So thank you, gentlemen. I salute you for your service and your great work, and we look forward to talking to you again. Well, as we said, we're going to wrap up the program this Sunday morning, this first weekend of October, on a musical note. And it's bittersweet, yes. After eight glorious seasons, the beloved music director of the Greater Bridgeport Symphony, Eric Jacobson, has announced he's going to be retiring at the end of next season. He's going to conduct the first and last concerts of this season and has recommended three amazing conductors, one of whom, we hope, will be selected to be the new music director next April. And to talk about the Greater Bridgeport Symphony is their executive director, Mark Halstead. Mark, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So before we get into some of the details and the many invitations that we can extend to our listeners, whether they live right there in Bridgeport or are far afield or out on Long Island or over in Westchester County or listening anywhere via podcasts, Greater Bridgeport Symphony really does provide an incredible musical destination there in the Park City.
Well, we've been so fortunate. We have a 75-year history. We were really blessed with Gustav Meyer for 42 years. And to follow up Gustav, who did so much for music, for classical music, for so many years, with Eric Jacobson these past years, 8 years, has been phenomenal. He's done great things to bring the orchestra really into the 21st century, the kind of music selection he does. The way he works with the orchestra and our musicians, it truly is a big family of musicians. They love each other. They love working with Eric. So that comes right across from the stage. And I think we are becoming more than just some local orchestra. We've become much more than that. And that, of course, brings up that we need to continue that trend as we move forward with someone other than Eric. But I'm very pleased that Eric has taken a very active role in choosing the four candidates that we have. And we're going to have a hard choice. I can tell you already, I've met two of the candidates and talked to the others briefly. They're all exciting. They're all more than qualified. And all bring something special and different to the table. So starting in November, we'll have the first of the so-called audition concerts with Benjamin Hockman. And we'll see him play the piano. as well as conduct. He's going to do a Beethoven, the Piano Concerto No. 1, and a Schumann Symphony. And then in December, we have a wonderful woman named Chelsea Gallo, who is new to the scene, but very dynamic, and she'll be coming in with a whole night of Tchaikovsky. And then in March, we have someone who's familiar to a lot of people in our metropolitan area here, Chelsea Tipton II. And Chelsea right now for several years has had the gig of being the Pops conductor for the New Haven Symphony. And he's actually conducted a couple of run-out concerts for us. Notably, during the pandemic, we actually had a concert before vaccines. We had an outdoor concert with 38 musicians and 450 spectators, and nobody got sick. And it was this hopeful ray of sunshine in the middle of the pandemic, and Chelsea conducted that. I could tell you one thing. He was one of the few people who never lost hope that that concert was going to happen. And so our audience knows him somewhat already. And we, as I said, very difficult choice with these great talents. Plus one other who played for us last year, Eduardo Leandro. He conducted last November, did a beautiful job conducting Beethoven 5, as well as a Jesse Montgomery piece. And it's a great concert, and it was great watching him work. So he's in the running, too.
Very nice. Well, you mentioned, obviously, the pandemic, which really was the death knell for many creative and cultural organizations across the country and around the world.
Yeah.
The Greater Bridgeport Symphony has survived. Hopefully haven't lost any members or supporters, and sustainability, we continue to hear, is really, really important. And there's a difference between staying sustainable and loyal to the traditions and roots of a cultural arts organization and reinventing it for the sake of trying to stay sustainable while appealing to perhaps a new audience. Let's talk a little bit about how you helped lead the Greater Bridgeport Symphony through these dark days of the pandemic, with the eye on remaining sustainable without necessarily feeling compelled to reinvent what has traditionally been the symphony's greatest aspects of success.
I think you really hit on it. It was sort of a pivoting or a repurposing of what we've always done well, but to grow larger at the same time. We did not lose any musicians, I don't believe, to the pandemic, but we have lost some of our longtime subscribers. But more than that, we've lost them to now sort of a permanent at-home status. That many, many of our subscribers this year are just saying, well, you know, we've gotten used to staying at home. Whereas if we'd had regular seasons in 20 and 21, they would have come back and subscribed, as they have some of them for decades. But now they're basically feeling homebound. It's a whole new ethos in the way people think about going out. That is a huge challenge because it's caused a big loss in our attendance at concerts. And it's a sad thing. But one of the things that we did, we decided early on in the pandemic that we would not let the music stop. And so we started small in September, November of 2020 to record our concerts. And actually the first recording was a quartet of Eric and some of our very greatest musicians that we have. And just putting that music out as a concert video to our subscribers, was a big, big thing. And then Eric came aboard on that so enthusiastically to say, let's try more. So as the season went on, we increased as we could from 25 musicians to 30 to 35 musicians by the end of the season, all recorded, all safe distancing and everything, all the rules we followed. Mm. And again, no one got sick, which was great, but we made the music. And I'm proud to say we kept our musicians employed and viable in their art. So this was great for them. But it was so great for our subscribers because we actually put all of those recorded concerts out on the same night that we had previously advertised would be a live concert. Before the pandemic, we said, okay, there'll be a concert on March 19th. And we put the videos out on March 19th so people could feel like, okay, you're going to stay at home and watch this. We're going to give you as much as possible the full feeling of the symphony orchestra playing its greatest music, interviews with Eric, interviews with our soloists, things that we can't normally do, backstage glimpses. So we actually continued that, and that's with huge help from our musician base itself, because recordings are a little bit of a touchy subject, of course, because can they be sold? The answer to that is no, they can't be. We've continued to make the recordings mostly for educational purposes, because we put these into schools last year in 2021, and we're still putting them into schools. So we always did archival recordings. Now these recordings become something visual, and there's something that we can relate to a new generation out there of viewers now. But there are still a few, and our orchestra committee and our musicians have been wonderful about saying, look, we understand there are still people who won't come out, can't come out because they don't feel comfortable. So we're able still to offer those of our subscribers, it's only maybe 10 or 20 this year, that really still want the music but can't come out, but we can give them the music. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, we have something to thank the pandemic for. We never would have thought it going this way. We didn't have to. But because the pandemic came along, we gained this entirely new capability, which I think is going to do great things for us in the future because of that outreach into schools particularly. This can go anywhere now. And being as it's educational use, it's part of what we normally do anyway, but it's a much bigger, better way of doing it than we've ever been able to do it before. So it's been a very tense time, a very exciting time, a time of we didn't know if these things would work or not. But they did, and so I'm very pleased to say that the Greater Bridgeport Symphony is in wonderful health. Creatively, we're in great health. Artistically, just rolling along, doing great things. And even to the point of the support we've gotten from our subscribers and the people who are out there still love us, they've been extra supportive to us. So that makes up for the fact that where normally we might see, we were averaging 1,000 per house at our concerts before the pandemic. And this year, I want us to average 700 or 800, and I think that is doable. Certainly, way down from where we have been, but it's a target that we're after. But as you can imagine, the revenues are down. But we have great, generous people that are helping us out, and they understand, I think, more than ever, the value of what we've been providing all this time.
Yes, and something else in regards to the value that you give. I mean, back when you and I were growing up, virtually every grammar school or elementary school and high school and the few middle schools that may have been around or intermediate schools and private schools when you and I were growing up, everybody had a school band or a school orchestra. Yeah. And some had, my high school had a concert band. It had a pep band. It had a jazz chorus. It had a concert chorus. It had small ensembles. It was a fantastic musical environment to be educated in. Today, budgetary constraints have forced music programs out of so many schools, and so many communities have had to lean on organizations like the Greater Bridgeport Symphony to fill in any way they can a gap in exposing young people to music education and the incredible benefits of acquiring and learning an instrument. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more in the last few minutes that we have with you, Mark, about the way the Greater Bridgeport Symphony has gone beyond just issuing interactive videos to the school community in Greater Bridgeport.
Well, we've always taken a very strong interest, especially in our hometown here in Bridgeport. As you mentioned, Fairfield County, most of the school districts are more affluent and can have really good music programs. So not that they don't need us, but they don't need us as critically as Bridgeport does. So we've made a real effort to go out into the schools and introduce music into the public schools. And we do that a couple different ways in the past 4 or 5 years, where we've gone in for school visits into elementary and middle schools. So Eric and a few of our musicians will go in and talk to the kids and play for the kids. It's kind of a one-time thing during the school year, and it has audiences of, one or two classrooms full of kids, so 20 kids or 200 kids in some cases. That's that's been great. One of the bigger things that we established was a rotating in-school concert for each of the three public high schools. So we've been doing that now since 2017, and these make a huge difference. I love to describe it as, you know, 200 kids come into the room. Most of them are thinking, great, free period, I could take a snooze or be on my phone the whole time. And I watch the crowd rather than the orchestra at that point. And I watch that, you know, 10 minutes in, they start looking up from their phones. And 20 minutes in, they're kind of putting the phone down in their lap. And 25 minutes in, they're putting the phone in their pocket. And so, of course, you don't get everybody. But if you get 20% of an audience like that, you get 30 or 40 kids that just gave classical music a chance and said, you know, there's something out there beyond their neighborhood, between the walls, beyond the walls of their classroom, there's bigger music. And the aspect of it that gets the most is the teamwork part of it, that these are 50 incredibly talented people coming together with their individual, and, you know, in the best sense of the word, their egos coming in. Mm. Their egos make them good musicians, great, but they also know how to play together and work as a team. And there's no augmentation. There's no electronics. The real thing is happening in front of them. This impresses the kids like you wouldn't believe. And to that end, we're going to do a video series. It's funded by one of our wonderful former trustees who passed. His family, the Hindlemeyer family, has come forward to give us funding for a four-part video series that will go into schools called Teamwork, which is going to focus on the teamwork aspects of the musicians themselves. Of course, that's primary. The education they go through, the training they go through. But also talk about my end of it, the marketing aspects, the business aspects, that it takes a year to put a concert together. It takes $90,000 to put a concert together. And we'll talk about stagecraft. We'll go backstage and look at what happens in prep and load in and load out, how all this happens, and going right into the minutiae such as like a music advisory committee meeting where ideas come out. So that's another project we have going. That'll be done by the end of, we hope, this coming year, maybe June or July, so we'll have it ready for next year.
Yeah, and showcasing, showcasing the multitude of career possibilities for those who may experiment on an instrument and find that that may not be for them, but they still have this falling in love kind of phenomena with the kind of music that the Greater Bridgeport Symphony creates.
Or, in fact, any musical career, for that matter, any career in marketing, any career in promotion of the arts. That's what we want it to be. You've really hit it. That we know that people may, you know, I always get the symphony face. I work for the symphony. They go, oh, you do? You know, not my cup of tea. So whether the music gets the kids in the video is less important than the fact that musicians and what they do, people who do the business side of things, people who do the stagecraft side of things, there's so many careers in there that something might interest a kid who never thought of it before, and that's what we want to get to. The other program we're really excited about that's just about to take off, we received an ARPA grant to do a mentorship program after school for Bridgeport kids, who are already proficient by the time they're in high school. Kids, those kind of kids who have been serious about an instrument for a while. And we want to foster that, give them lessons with our musicians, mentoring lessons and guidance, so that by the time they're juniors or seniors, they're ready to audition for the orchestra to do a side-by-side. And the aim is that every year at our last concert, we have a contingent of kids from Bridgeport coming onto stage with us, playing with us on the stage. We did this twice before on a one-off kind of basis. And not only was it great for the kids, but the audience responds. And they say, it's so great that there are kids up there. This is hope. This is classical music isn't just for those 55 and over. This isn't AARP territory anymore. It's something much bigger. And so the audience responds. And I never heard applause like I did when we did Cuban Overture with a bunch of kids from Mexico. It was all over the region. We needed brass, wind, and percussion kids. And we had 8 or 10 of them on stage. Never heard applause like that before or since. That people respond when the community gets involved, and when you can show that in such a tangible, wonderful way, that's something we're looking forward to. Maybe not this year, we're getting the program off the ground, but within a year or two, we want to have kids on the stage every April with us.
Fantastic. So we want to let folks know if they want more information or to learn how to be a subscriber or to get tickets or to make a donation to the Greater Bridgeport Symphony.
We like all those things.
Yes. it's a real hard-to-remember website, gbs.org.
Well, Greater people Bridgeport got to remember Symphony. That it's a B in the middle for Bridgeport, proudly for Bridgeport, because yes. People say GPS. So they think it's Global Positioning System.
Yep. But, and we want to remind them that coming up on Saturday, November 12th, is the first turn of the Turn series.
That's right.
With Benjamin Hockman, then Saturday, December 17th with Chelsea Gallo, and next spring, Saturday, March 18th with Chelsea Tipton II.
Tipton?
Right? And folks
and then
can just
go Farewell with Eric on April 8th.
Yep. And so gbs.org is where to go for more information, for tickets, and for anything you want to know about the Greater Bridgeport Symphony. We want to thank you.
Do feel free to call our office, 576-0263. I'm the one in the office, usually Monday, Wednesday, and Friday afternoons. Happy to talk to anybody about the symphony and whatever they would like to know about it, because we have family deals, we have student deals. We want to get people into those seats. Mm-hmm. And this year we're going to go to real extraordinary measures to do that. So if you've got a group out there that wants to come to the symphony, we want you.
Mark Halstead, Greater Bridgeport Symphony's Executive Director, wrapping up the program this morning. Thank you, sir, and keep the music coming. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Imagine a school day built around your child's needs and interests. It's possible with K-12. K-12-powered schools are accredited, tuition-free, online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn from state-certified teachers trained to teach online. And with the flexibility to learn wherever there's internet, it can fit into any family schedule. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. You can make the switch at any time. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more.